From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Paul Farmer about his approach to community-based health care after 20-some years fighting poverty and disease in Haiti. Farmer is an infectious disease specialist, a medical anthropologist, and the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Also, fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi tells us about classic Hollywood movies that influenced his sense of style. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Money Records, the imitation Motown label, and TV critic David Bianculli gives us his take on the new TV season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congress has passed legislation designed to allow a national do-not-call list to go into effect next week as planned. The legislation, passed overwhelmingly by the House and Senate, makes it clear that the Federal Trade Commission has the authority to operate a list of people who don't want to be called with sales pitches from telemarketers. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled that the FTC didn't have the authority to prevent telemarketers from calling the people on the list. Telemarketers have also argued that the list interferes with their free speech. Representative Greg Walden, an Oregon Republican, said the list protects the free speech of consumers.
These citizens have expressed their rights to uninterrupted free speech at the dinner table, and the breakfast table, and the lunch table, and the middle of the night.
A second federal judge in Denver has just ruled in favor of the telemarketers on the free speech issue. A member of the Iraqi Interim Governing Council who was attacked by gunmen 5 days ago has died. Other members of the council are blaming supporters of Saddam Hussein. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Akila al-Hashimi was one of 3 women on Iraq's Interim Governing Council. She was the only member of the U.S. selected group to have served in Saddam Hussein's government as a top aide to former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz and later as Iraq's Director of International Relations. Today, the top U.S. official in Iraq, Paul Bremer, called Hashimi a pioneer for freedom and democracy. British Prime Minister Tony Blair expressed shock and dismay at her death. Hashimi was shot in the abdomen by unknown attackers last Saturday while traveling in a car with bodyguards near her home. She was being treated at a U.S. military hospital on the grounds of Saddam Hussein's former Republican palace in Baghdad. She died there. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
A federal judge is giving the Interior Department another chance to account for mismanaged Indian trust money. The move stalls the class action lawsuit brought by hundreds of thousands of Native Americans who allege the federal government owes them millions of dollars. Allison Aubrey reports from Washington.
Federal Judge Royce Lamberth has set 2007 as the deadline for a new accounting of Indian trust dollars. The decision is a setback for Native American plaintiffs who argue that the Department of Interior is incapable of accounting for the money they say should have been paid into the Indian Trust Fund over the past century. During a 44-day trial this summer, lawyers for the Indian account holders argued that Interior had lost or destroyed too many documents to complete an accurate accounting, and they asked Judge Lamberth to strip the department of its oversight role. The Interior Department has said it will take 5 years and $335 million to account for the Indian money. Alice Nobry, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 81 points to close at 93.44 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was down 28 to 18.17. This is NPR News. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has ordered more United Nations staff members to leave the organization's mission in Iraq. The order to withdraw 19 of the organization's 105 international staff members came after the second bombing outside the UN headquarters in Baghdad. That bombing on Monday killed the bomber and an Iraqi guard and left 19 other people hurt. An earlier bombing at the UN offices killed 22 people in August. The count of the dead from the August heat wave in France has gone up again to almost 15,000. The new number, calculated by a national research body, is 3,000 higher than the previous estimate. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
The jump in the death toll comes from different counting methods. The previous government estimate only looked at the first 2 weeks in August when temperatures stayed above 100 degrees. The latest estimate by health researchers looks at the entire month of August. It includes the weak and elderly who died from health problems related to the heat wave, but shortly after it actually happened. The latest count suggests that some 14,800 more people died this August than last, and that those deaths can be attributed to the weather. A government investigation into the causes of the extra deaths blamed doctors for going on vacation, and it said the different parts of France's health administration weren't talking to each other. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Emergency officials in Japan say there were many injuries today in a strong earthquake that struck the northern island of Hokkaido. There are conflicting reports, but some say dozens of people have been hurt. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake had a magnitude of 7.8, and it was followed by an aftershock with a magnitude of 6. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine FFR presents new thinking about balancing the demands of jobs and family life on the web at fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Can one person really change the world? Dr. Paul Farmer is making the case that all of us have that potential. Farmer is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he chairs the Department of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He won a MacArthur Genius Award for creating a public health system in Conj, Haiti, in the midst of a squatter settlement devastated by poverty and disease. Through his foundation, Partners in Health, he and his colleagues are providing not only basic medical care to nearly a million Haitians, they've also built schools and water sanitation systems. And they've accomplished things that many have claimed were impossible in impoverished communities, like successfully treating drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis and reducing the incidence of HIV. Working with governmental agencies and international organizations like the WHO, Farmer has pursued similar programs in Peru, Russia, and in Boston, Massachusetts. He's the subject of a new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, by Tracy Kidder. Farmer first came to Haiti when he was 23, after studying for a degree in medical anthropology. I asked him what he saw there that made him want to start his own rural hospital.
If you go to a hospital and you need, say, for example, you have obstructed labor, that is, you're at your due date, you're pregnant, you're at your due date, the baby doesn't come out. And if you have $700, you can have a cesarean section, and if you don't have $700, you don't receive appropriate medical care. And I had seen this happen in a couple of the clinics and facilities, hospitals that I visited in Haiti, and I thought it would be intolerable to work in those conditions. And, you know, illness after illness, I mention obstructed labor because that was something that hit me early on. You know, it hadn't occurred to me really at the age of 23 or 24 that, you know, your social standing would determine whether or not you survived pregnancy.
So could you describe for us then the scope of the medical services that the complex provides that's funded by your charity group Partners in Health?
Well, you know, it's actually a very ambitious endeavor now. There's 104 beds. There are two operating rooms. There's a dental clinic, an ophthalmology clinic, a women's health clinic. We have an HIV and TB clinic, probably the first AIDS treatment program in a really poor country. All in one very concentrated campus. I suppose it's utopian or maybe impossible to have a Brigham and Women's Hospital in the middle of a squatter settlement in central Haiti, but it's a pretty good, you know, dream to aspire to. And so that was the goal. But of course you start with an idea like that and soon you find out that the children that you're taking good care of for their complex diseases, they're also not in school. Or you see the 1,000th case of typhoid, and you know that that's because people don't have clean drinking water. Or you see a whole family living in a very tiny hut, all with tuberculosis, and realize that, of course, not only do they not have access to care for tuberculosis, they also don't have adequate housing. So it sort of opens a Pandora's box. Once you start doing a good job taking care of, you know, taking care of sick people, which is what a doctor or a nurse does, and become involved in their lives and visit them at home, you discover that they're not just sick; they're facing what seem to some to be insuperable problems. I personally don't believe they're insuperable problems, and neither do my many coworkers and colleagues in Haiti, most of whom are Haitian. We believe they're problems that can be addressed with the right kind of conviction and resources.
So what kind of money does it take to make this work? And do you charge patients for treatment?
It takes very little money to make this sort of thing work. Just to give a specific example, there was finally a study of how much it cost to take care of a patient with tuberculosis in the city of Chicago. And this is just regular tuberculosis because, you know, we've worked with very complicated forms of tuberculosis that are difficult and expensive to treat. But if you added up hospitalization costs in special kind of rooms that TB patients go into in a U.S. hospital, and the care provided by doctors and nurses in the public health department, they came up with a figure of $68,000 per patient per cure. And we provide excellent care for tuberculosis in rural Haiti with community-based care, and in which a community health worker visits the patient every day. And we have cure rates that are even better than many posted in American cities. And we can do that for under $200. So I think that it doesn't cost a lot to do a good job.
How is that possible, though? How do you keep costs down?
Well, for one thing, we rely on community health workers to do the everyday work. And that's what we did when we decided, when we became the first clinic in Haiti to decide, well, many are arguing that it's not cost-effective or even possible to treat AIDS in a country this poor. And we had already decided that we weren't going to listen to that sort of logic because our mandate is to remediate inequalities of access to care, that is to take care of the destitute sick. So we already had a mandate that we worked hard to develop. So when AIDS came along to rural Haiti, we felt impelled to try and introduce the same standard of care, or maybe even better, than what you'd get in Boston. And the way it became possible is because we'd already learned from our experience at delivering prenatal care or tuberculosis care to use community health workers. And, you know, community health workers are not volunteers, but the labor costs in Haiti are very low. And there's enormous interest among villagers to become trained as community health workers or village health workers. And that's one of the reasons that, A, our costs are low, and B, our outcomes are excellent. That is, these people do a very good job delivering care.
Well, I want to talk about some of the other changes you've made in your program or improvements you made in your program that other hospitals don't pursue or other international medical projects don't pursue. And one of them is you travel to see patients when they don't come in for treatment, your aid workers at the hospital. And also when you travel to Haiti, you also do this. And you'll travel hours walking through into the mountains to track patients down to make sure that they get their treatment. And this is a rule at your hospital. Why?
Well, we had this traumatic experience in 1988, which is 15 years ago. And we had... The clinic had been founded 3 years earlier, and we don't pay for tuberculosis medications. The Haitian government, the Ministry of Health, provides us these medications. And so, as in most countries, in principle, and we thought in our own clinic, that TB care, tuberculosis care, was free. Well, in 1988, three people from right around the clinic died of tuberculosis, and that was... a very traumatic experience for me, for the, at that time we had only one doctor, and for the community health workers on whom we relied. And there were several nurses at the time. And we got together and said, what happened here? How could we lose three otherwise healthy young people, parents with kids, how could we lose them to this eminently treatable disease? And it was interesting. There were all these discrepant theories as to what had happened. And some people, and it was really mostly the professionals, they tended to blame the patients. And they brought up this whole idea of, you know, they believe in voodoo and they're superstitious, and that's why they die of tuberculosis, even though they have free care, but the community health workers who shared the social conditions of the patients who died, they didn't agree, by and large. They said, no, these are the poorest patients who died. And when we started looking harder that year at our so-called free TB treatment program, we found all kinds of hidden costs. For example, we found that it costs money to get to the clinic if you were too sick to walk. And even if you could walk, you know, for 3 hours, you're not doing something else. If you're a peasant farmer, you're not planting, you're not hoeing. But for people who couldn't walk, they had to pay to borrow a donkey. And then we found that, you know, at that time we were using a drug called streptomycin. It's not used as widely anymore. It's a good TB drug, but you have to give it as an injection. And we found out that they were paying people to give them the injection in the village. And so what we did is we just eradicated every single barrier to free care, and then we felt we could have an honest conversation. But only after we made the care really free to the patient could we have an honest discussion as to why these people died. And so I have to say, you know, since that time, since we overhauled the project, we haven't lost patients to tuberculosis.
Why do you, though, do that kind of work? Why are you doing hands-on work in the clinic now and visiting patients in faraway regions? I would think your time is very short. You have this huge project that you help administer and fundraise for.
Well, I do it because I like it. It's my favorite part of the work, the clinical work and visiting patients in their homes, or really, they're not homes, they're huts. But and as you said, we get some of our best ideas by walking a long way and thinking about what patients must be going through. If I could give you one example, I remember the day distinctly that I ran into a patient who had a child on her arm, and she had the child, I think, was about 3, and she had come from the clinic, and I offered, because she looked so, the woman had looked sick herself, and the child was sick, and she had not been seen at the clinic. She'd brought her kid there, and I said, can I help you carry the baby? And she threw me this look, first of all, incredulous, and then grateful. And it was a 3-hour hike to her home village. And after a half an hour of carrying this 3-year-old, who was a malnourished child, my arm started to hurt. And after an hour of carrying that child, my arm was really killing me. And so, you know, I, being not sick, I did make it all the way to that village the rest of the way with the kid on my arm. And I sat down and I was fanning myself with a piece of paper I had. And I said to her, well, you know, my arm hurts from carrying that child, from carrying your baby. Doesn't it hurt your arm? And she said, if I go to your clinic with one of my infants, my arm hurts for weeks afterwards. And, you know, it had never occurred to me before. I never thought about it. And I can think about all these things I learn from, you know, on the way to these villages that are obviously very far away from the fundraising or the international conferences or the work that is regarded as really important by some. But I think you do learn things by sticking close to the patients and their conditions.
I'm talking with Dr. Paul Farmer. He's the founding director of the charity organization Partners in Health, which supports medical services in Haiti, also projects in Peru, in Russia, and in Boston, Massachusetts. Farmer is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's the subject of a new book by Tracy Kidder called Mountains Beyond Mountains. We're going to take a break now, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Paul Farmer. He's the founding director of the charity organization Partners in Health, which funds medical clinics and medical services in Haiti, Peru, Russia, also here in the U.S. and in Boston. Paul Farmer is profiled in the new book Mountain Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder. Part of the problem in fighting many of these epidemics, AIDS, also TB, is that the drugs are very expensive. You've had some success getting drug companies to lower the price of drugs in order to implement your projects. How do you do that? It sounds impossible.
Well, you know, there's all sorts of different tricks, I might say, and some of it is cajoling, and sometimes it's working with individuals within these big companies who are sympathetic to the cause. Sometimes it's working with generic manufacturers in other countries. But the fact remains that, I think it was the Indian Minister of Health who said once said in term reference to AIDS drugs, if you can drop the prices by 80%, it suggests that there was something wrong with the initial price setting to start with. And I think that's true. You know, the TB drugs had been off patent for years. There's no reason that they should have cost that much. And we proved that you could drop the drug prices by 95% with most of them.
Well, you were working on this project before you were able to negotiate lower prices for these drugs, and there is a story that Tracy Kidder tells in the book about you, in which it involves you and a colleague borrowing drugs from the hospital that you you work in Boston. Can you tell me about that?
What are you trying to get me fired?
Well, $92,000
no.
worth of drugs?
Well, we just borrowed it. No, the colleague that you're talking about is Jim Kim. And we were working in a hospital that, you know, that had these drugs on hand but didn't have the patients. The patients were in Peru. And so we were borrowing the drugs.
Yeah, how did that work? Did you have friends in the pharmacy,
yes,
and they would
we promised to pay back the pharmacy. I'm not sure we had a very clear strategy at the time, but when the president of the hospital he asked about this, and then also his successor did too. Our biggest supporter, a man named Tom White, came and bailed us out and paid off our debts to the pharmacy. But, and you know, again, the thing that makes me uncomfortable about the story is that it does make it sound like extraordinary measures are required to stop an epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis, when in fact I think what's required is political will. I mean, why should, you know, one of these drugs, a gram, which is a day's supply, cost $29 at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and, you know, you could find it for $8 in Paris made, you know, by the same company. So, you know, we tried buying it in Paris. There were enough patients, and this is a disease that takes a long time to treat. Our patients were poor. They weren't going to be able to pay for these drugs. And we were trying to find ways of making sure that they never missed a dose. And they didn't miss a dose.
I want to ask you about some of the arguments that are offered against offering medical aid and international support for large-scale projects that combat infectious diseases. And one of them is that cultural differences will make it problematic to properly treat patients. And that was part of the bias against funding drug treatment to HIV patients in Africa. How does religion or cultural mores enter into the work that you do? And I'm thinking many Haitians believe in voodoo or sorcery and seek other treatments for disease.
Well, you know, this is one of those instances in which it was really helpful to not to have training in anthropology, to have a doctoral degree in anthropology, but to be able to say, that's not true, and I'm also an anthropologist. Because really the arguments that cultural beliefs or religious beliefs will serve as barriers to effective care are this is perhaps not a very scholarly term, but they're just bogus. There's no evidence really to show that that's what the barrier to care is, and frankly, I really don't believe that that is why we can't treat AIDS in Africa. I believe we can't treat AIDS in Africa because powerful people, decision makers, still don't have the political will that we need in order to move even community health, to pay community health workers. We don't need big infrastructures to treat AIDS, or tuberculosis for that matter, or drug-resistant malaria. What we need are the medicines and the community health workers, and make sure that the community health workers are paid at least a modest stipend so that they can do this job and not another job, like such as planting corn or millet for their family to eat.
Is it possible to have political will at the level it would require to be effective to institute these changes?
Well, you know, hope springs eternal, but that means Washington, Tokyo, Paris, Munich, Geneva. I think the political will we need is in the rich countries and in, I mean, for example, this is pretty dull stuff, but the international financial institutions like the World Bank. I mean, the World Bank is the leading funder of TB control, and what they decide, what kind of TB gets treated, how it's done, that lays down the law for most of these poorer countries. So that's where the political will needs to be summoned.
There's something very interesting, a quote in the book. You say you've organized your life around areas of moral clarity. Can you talk about what you mean by moral clarity?
Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of things in a book like that that you wish you'd never said. You know,
I'm sure I'll hit on everyone.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, when you spend the way that the author of that book works is he just hangs around and hangs around with you so long that you basically tell him anything he wants to hear. And so, you know, when you talk about areas of moral clarity, I don't know, maybe it sounds a little sophomoric, but I feel that when you're a physician or, again, a nurse, and you know the answer to a problem, a patient's problem, that it's a good thing to act and save lives or prevent suffering. And so in some ways, maybe that's a cop-out answer. That is, people who are trained as healers who are around the sick, they should have plenty of areas of moral clarity. But as you point out, things are very complicated in the doing, and you know, the devil's in the details. We made errors along the way, and we're going to make errors, I'm sure, in the future. But it seems like if you could have more successes than make errors in a world so fraught with problems and riven by social inequality, that you might be on the right track. And I don't know if I'd push it much farther than that, because then it'll sound like I've happened on some great solutions and know the answers to lots of problems that I don't know the answers to.
Well, it's a real honor to talk with you, Dr. Paul Farmer. Thank you
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a real privilege to be on the show.
Dr. Paul Farmer is the founding director of Partners in Health and the head of the Department of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's the subject of Tracy Kidder's new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, from Vintage Books, paperback publishers of the new novel Caramello by Sandra Cisneros, author of The House on Mango Street, and by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the new album Stumble Into Grace by Emmylou Harris, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we look at some classic Hollywood movies through the eyes of fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi. He's participating in the Style and Motion series on Turner Classic Movies next month. Also, Ed Ward tells us about Money Records, and David Bianculli takes a look at the new TV season. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. As the black record industry saw Motown getting more and more successful in the 60s, veterans of the business asked why Detroit should have all the luck. Of all the imitation Motowns that sprung up in that decade, probably none was as successful as Money. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us the story of Money Records.
Money Records was the last gasp of one of LA's most famous record empires. The Dolphin Records Group had been in existence since the late 40s, an outgrowth of the Dolphins of Hollywood record stores, owned by John and Ruth Dolphin, far from Hollywood in what is today South Central LA. The Dolphins had used the name Money before. They had a bewildering number of labels, but it was revived in 1964, 6 years after John Dolphin had been shot to death by a songwriter who said he owed him money. The man behind the new Money Records was the DJ who played records in the window of the Dolphins record stores, Al A.C. Scott, who also managed the stores and had a show on KGFJ. Scott knew the local scene well enough that he wanted to start the label with a proven winner. So when Don Julian walked into the office with some reels of tape, he took notice. Julian had led a local group, Don Julian and the Meadowlarks, for many years, and they'd always done well. Now, Julian told Scott, he'd just been to his sister's house and her teenage kids were doing a new dance, so he'd recorded a song about it and called his group The Larks. The song got to 9 on the soul charts and 7 on the pop charts and started a craze. Over 60 more Jerk songs came out over the next year, and Julian wound up running a record label called Jerk, which was, of course, a division of Money. A.C. Scott was in business, so the next thing was to find an artist who could be developed into a star. 21-year-old Betty Champion from Shreveport, Louisiana, was the one. She changed her name to Betty Swan, thinking Champion brought up unfeminine images of boxers. And best of all, she wrote her own material.
Good things come to those who wait, but don't wait too long. Good things come to those who wait, but don't wait too long. Because love is just a merry-go-round. Before you know it, your love will be gone.
Her first record, Don't Wait Too Long, was a mild soul hit and sold well locally, but it was the follow-up that made her reputation and even broke onto the pop charts.
I never had a love to call my own. I was about to give up, and then you came along just to have your tender ways. Thrills me for days and days. I don't care what nobody says. I want you for always.
Make Me Yours hit the top of the soul charts, and now, with 3 hits under his belt, Scott started signing up more and more acts. Bobby Angel was one of them.
I keep on hearing you call my name, even when I'm asleep. And every time my telephone rings, my heart just skips a beat.
Angel was one example of the problems Money faced. He sang a bit like James Brown, and yet the backing track sounded a bit like Motown. Not a good mix. In fact, for a while, Money had a big M on their label that looked a lot like the one Motown used. And, particularly on the records produced by Arthur Wright, the sound was a lot like Motown's, putting a vibraphone right up front, or using that metronomic tambourine.
Good things come to those who wait.
The not-quite-Motown sound made Money legendary among British fans of what they call Northern Soul. But like much of Northern Soul, it sounds fairly derivative to Americans who got to hear a lot more of this kind of music than the BBC ever played. Still, there was one artist that Money signed who would later become a legend. Ted Hawkins was rediscovered in the late 80s living on the beach in Venice, California, and he still had his amazing Sam Cooke sound-alike voice. He'd been in and out of prisons and hospitals before he cut Baby in 1966, and he never really changed. But in 1994, he was able to cut an album for Geffen that made him a star for a brief moment before he died. The rest of Money's stable never really did too well, and although there's a Larks album from 1974, the label was pretty much history by the end of the 60s. Betty Swan went on recording till the end of the 70s, and Don Julian and the Larks were still playing in 1998 when Julian died. Today, Money, and indeed all of the Dolphins of Hollywood Empire, are all but forgotten, except by those crazy British soul fans.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Coming up, classic Hollywood films through the eyes of a fashion designer. This is Fresh Air. Monday nights in October, the cable network Turner Classic Movies is presenting a special series, Style in Motion, featuring conversations about fashion and film with such designers as Kate and Andy Spade, Badge Limishka, Michael Kors, and my guest, Isaac Mizrahi. Mizrahi says films like Roberta, The Women, Darling, and Blow Up ruined him for life, that nothing today can compare to the elegance of those pictures, their romance and panache. Here's a scene from the 1935 film Roberta, about a Paris fashion house. In this scene, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers are trying to lure Irene Dunne back to Roberta's salon after she quits. Fred Astaire is showing Dunne some designs he thinks Roberta's should put out.
But this is like the mode two seasons back.
I know, but I liked them better then.
But nobody will buy them. Well, you'd be laughed out of Paris if you did a thing like that. The trend is away from such styles.
I'm not interested in the trend.
But you've got to be. You don't understand. You're giving a fashion show next week. Every couturier in Europe is going to be watching. You can't afford to show models like those.
Well, of course you cannot. Stefania is right.
What does it matter as long as they're pretty?
But clothes must be more than pretty. Look, the trouble with that is it fits in the wrong places.
Such a pity. The famous Roberta to go second rate.
Robertas will never go second rate.
Isaac Mizrahi, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, such a pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking about the film Roberta. It's a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie. What I always notice about their films, the clothes look so perfect when they're dancing. You know, all that satin and the high-waisted, wide-legged pants and skirts on Ginger Rogers, they flow so beautifully. And Fred Astaire's tails on his tux always swing just right.
That's just right.
Is that why this film is on your list?
Well, yes, of course, that's one of the reasons it's on my list, but it happens to be about a fashion house in Paris. The movie is like, you know, a sort of a tale about an old lady who surprisingly dies and leaves this whole sort of couturier to Irene Dunne, actually. You know, it's just the tale of a couturier in Paris, which is why, you know, for me, when I was approached by Turner to do this little festival of pictures about clothes, I decided that they would actually literally be stories about fashion, do you know? Whereas you could think of, I could have thought of millions of pictures that I really loved the clothes in or that clothes were sort of mentioned in or something. But these are my actual favorite movies about fashion.
So everyone is just covered in yards and yards of fur. I mean, that's the first thing
you notice. Yards and yards of fur and satin and jewels and, you know, honestly, I have to say the clothes aren't by anyone particularly famous. I don't think they're Adrian. I know they're not Adrian. I know they're not, you know, someone who went on to do like fabulous, like I don't think they're Walter Plunkett or any of those great designers. But they're a little bit, to me, they're a little bit like sort of unrestrained, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, everyone
they're
looks a little over
vulgar.
The top.
They're overstated, I would say.
Well, I wanted to go to this idea of the 30s Art Deco extravagance. I wondered if you wish in some part of you for those days back. I know your clothes had featured fur and a certain kind of extravagance. Right. I mean, it's such a way of reveling in luxury and textures and that kind of forbidden fruit.
I have to say, I don't really look back and wish for any particular thing. But I will say, I look back and I wish that one could be as earnest as that, you know? Today, you sort of, for the past, like, let's say 20 years or even 30 years, you really can't be all that earnest with beauty.
What
you know
does
what
that
I mean?
To be earnest with beauty as a designer?
You know, in other words, there always has to be some little bit of irony that throws it off, you know? Like something, you know, today, if you make a dress that's all that beautiful, maybe it has to be slightly wrinkled. Do you know what I mean? It has to be like, it has to look like it's coming from a thrift store, you know?
You're just not trying that hard.
Yeah. Honestly, otherwise, if I gave you the dress, right, and I said, Barbara, you know, wear this, you'd put it on and you wouldn't be able to. You just couldn't walk out the house in something that gorgeous. Do you know what I mean? You'd have to somehow mess it up. Like you'd have to mess up your hair or wear it with sneakers or something. You know, I mean, there has to be some kind of irony today. I mean, you stand in front of the mirror. I know you do, Barbara. Don't lie to me, okay? I know you stand there and you look perfect.
In my fur and my ball gown and satin.
Seriously, no, you look beautiful and you say, oh, that's a little too beautiful. I have to do something to this, like put a bandana on or something, right?
God forbid.
Well, I think everybody knows what I mean. You know, you can't. It's like in the 1950s, you wore like crinolines and heels and full makeup and crazy hairdos, and it was all so incredibly courtly. You know, it was so put together.
Right, and unapologetic.
Today, if you're going to do something like that, right, it was unapologetic, just earnest.
Do you look to films for inspiration?
Well, yes. I mean, the answer to that question, of course, is yes. But to sort of really state what goes on, I don't look to films for inspiration. They sort of find me or something. That's what happens.
So what do you look for? Are you looking for that tiny spark of inspiration, like the shape of a sleeve or the drape of a coat or a trouser? Or is it something as ineffable as style with a capital S?
It's both. And in fact, you know, the point is that you don't really look. There was once I was doing a collection and I was having problems with skirts in general, right?
What was the problem?
Oh, the problem was they just weren't looking good. I couldn't figure out what the hell length to make them. You know, it just wasn't working at a certain particular time. And I happened to be watching a series of pictures with Katharine Hepburn, right? And I noticed that mostly she wore trousers and looked great in trousers, right? So what I did was instead of trying to figure out skirts, I did trousers in place of skirts, you know? So I did like ball gowns, but with trousers. You know, somehow I managed to do that. It sort of pushed the envelope. And that year, it turned out everybody was having problems with skirts. I wasn't the only one. So it was like a big pants year, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that sounds retarded, but that's, I'm serious. That's what happens.
Did people buy them?
Yeah. You know, people bought them. Yes, they did.
Another film you chose to talk about for the series is The Women. I love this movie. I have to say, though, that the script is so outstanding, it almost overshadows the visuals in my memory.
Oh, yes.
You know, there are all these amazing actresses like Joan Crawford and Norma Shearer and Rosalind Russell and Mary Boland, and they all talk so fast that you have to concentrate really hard on the dialogue, and I have hardly any brain cells left to notice what they're wearing.
Or, you know what, like me, you see it, you know, 50 times and you memorize the dialogue, and then, you know, it's easy to just take a little nap through part of it and just look at the clothes.
What are your favorite dresses or outfits from this film?
Oh, there are so many, I have to say. You know, the period is probably my favorite all-time period for fashion, which is the late 1930s, 1938 and 1939, because it has all of the glamour and the polish of the 1930s, and it's getting even more structured, you know? Like, there's a shoulder that's starting to become a bit more prominent, like a Lego mutton sleeve. Do you know what that is?
A Lego mutton sleeve,
sort of like a little puffy sleeve, right? Hats were so, like, sort of incredibly silly and prevalent and architectural. They were starting to become really aggressive by the middle of the 40s, but here they're just beginning to sprout, you know? Let's see, some of my favorite dresses in this picture, you know, it's Norma Shearer has this amazing sort of black dress that is this big ball gown thing. And it looks almost like a Singer Sargent painting of Madame X or something, you know. It's very bare on top, but it's very, very sort of classical and, you know, it's the high road of bare. You know, it's just her shoulders are bare and the rest of her is very covered. And it has a beautiful little hat that goes with it. Now, okay, I don't know about you, but the idea of an evening dress with an evening hat just makes me swoon. where was I? you know, there's a fantastic sort of a sequin dress that Joan Crawford has at the end. Just sensational dress and this big sort of chinchilla cape that she puts on top of it. That's just the ultimate luxury.
Are there any things that you notice watching these films that are on their way back? I'm thinking of gloves.
Well, actually, now that you mention it, gloves are coming back, aren't they? That's so true. Gloves and, I think, hats in a certain way.
Yeah, although I have a theory about hats that you...
What is it?
That women don't go to the hairdresser the way they did in the 50s or the 40s, and
that's
so
right.
You can't be walking around in a hat and having hat hair.
No, you're absolutely right about that, about, like, you know... What is the hats? What are the hats in the women, if not for the coifs under the hats? But in a lot of instances, you are covering your hair.
So it does fit in the 21st century.
That's right.
Are there any other things that caught your eye that you think are making a comeback?
Well, you know what's come back is everything. You know, you can't really say what isn't anymore. You know, it's just like every period, it's become such a pastiche of the 1930s and the 1960s and the 1970s. It's really like there isn't anything that isn't right anymore. It's what's wrong is the way you put it together, you know. The degree of irony, the degree of sort of, you know, of humor that you use when you put these things together, that's what changes. That's what looks wrong or right, do you know? It's true, and every woman knows what the hell I'm talking about, I think, you know. It isn't what you're wearing, it's how you're wearing it now.
It's been a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun being here. Thank you.
Fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi. He's one of six designers featured on a special series, Style in Motion, airing Monday nights in October on Turner Classic Movies. Coming up, we preview the new TV season. This is Fresh Air. After months of summer reruns and reality shows, Broadcast Network Television is now midway through its official fall premiere week. TV critic David Bianculli is sad to report that, for the most part, he doesn't think it was worth the wait.
Every fall, the networks trot out about 40 new shows, hoping to strike a nerve, launch a hit, and preserve or change their own primetime standings. This fall, 20 of those shows already have premiered. 8 more will be introduced tonight through Sunday, and the rest will dribble out in October and November. I've seen all of them, including the ones that won't show up until the World Series is over. And there's not one must-see show in the bunch. Not one. That's bad. Just a few seasons ago at this time, I was able to rave about the excitement and vision of new shows called 24 and Alias. Last year, there was Boomtown. This year, the show I'm most enthused about is the new Joe Pantoliano show called The Handler, which basically is a cross between Mission Impossible and Wise Guy. Entertaining? Yes. Groundbreaking? No. At all the networks, the approach to series development this season has been to play it safe. There are police procedural shows and family sitcoms, and new series spun off of old TV shows and movies. There's even a Tarzan update on the WB, which is very funny. Unfortunately, it's not supposed to be. Exemplifying this conservative approach this year is NBC, which tonight launches its 10th and final season of Friends. This is the network's last chance to introduce a new show that could someday follow in that show's footsteps and keep NBC's Thursday lineup from slipping significantly in the ratings race. So what does it do? It takes a British sitcom called Coupling and recasts the show using pretty much the same scripts. I liked the British version, shown here on BBC America, but the first 2 episodes of the Americanized Coupling are oddly flat. Some jokes are overplayed. Others, some of the best ones, are cut out entirely. Both versions of Coupling, a show about 6 attractive young people who hang out together, have been accused by most TV critics of copying Friends. Actually, that's not fair. What Coupling really tries to copy is Seinfeld, especially in the way the characters find their own ways to define things. Here's a scene from the original British pilot of Coupling, in which one guy suggests an unflattering term for a persistent ex-girlfriend.
Steve, do you know what I call this kind of woman? You know, the type you can't get rid of.
Is this going to be really tasteless? Am I going to be ashamed to be your friend?
It's a technical term, right? It's just a harmless expression.
All right. Hit me.
Unflushable.
Turn around, Jeff, quick away.
You know, because they keep bobbing around.
No, go, Jeff, go! Go.
I'd let you listen to the American version of that same scene, but it doesn't exist. NBC cut it, just as they cut a lot of the other memorable or subtle lines from the original shows. All that's left are 2 good performances from Rena Sofer and Lindsay Price, and that may not be enough. In the CBS drama series The Handler, Joe Pantoliano's performance is enough. He plays the head of an undercover FBI squad. In this scene, which opens the series, he's trying to force a young woman into his car during a driving rainstorm. It turns out she's a new FBI trainee, and he's trying to teach her what to expect and avoid on the street.
Look, you think you could just sell on my corner my customers because you want to?
I didn't see any sign that said that you own the street.
You weren't looking close enough.
You got a map in your car?
What?
Why don't you just show me what part of the city you don't own and I'll go sell over there?
Ready yet? Get in the car. I'll give you a ride and show you myself.
Why don't you just pump me some dope and I can stay where I am and we can both be happy. What?
No, you can't do that. No, that's entrapment. You gotta get him to make the suggestion. Let him come to you. But the attitude was good. I like that. You're not a pushover and you didn't get in the car. That's important. And listen, what you did, getting sexy with me?
Yeah.
Don't do it unless you plan on going all the way with it.
He's good enough to watch and support that show, and the rest of the cast is intriguing too. The Handler is worth sampling. So, in the next few days, are Joan of Arcadia on CBS, Rob Lowe's new series The Lion's Den on NBC, and Karen Sisko on ABC. But there's not a 24 or an Alias in the bunch, and that's a bit frustrating. What's not frustrating is that those shows have survived and are coming back. Alias this Sunday, 24 not until the end of October. If we can't get excited about any of the new shows, at least we can be happy that so many wonderful old ones made the cut for another year. The West Wing, which returned last night without series creator Aaron Sorkin at the helm, will take a few episodes to resolve last season's major cliffhanger, in which Martin Sheen's President Bartlett stepped down after his daughter was kidnapped by international terrorists. John Goodman, as the Republican Speaker of the House, is now in charge at the Oval Office, and his performance effectively shatters the show's complacency and status quo. As for The Practice, which returns Sunday, half of its cast was fired in order to save the show. But the series has plenty of star power anyway. It's hired James Spader to play a lawyer joining the firm in the first episode, and beginning in the second show, producer David E. Kelley has written a multi-episode guest role for Sharon Stone. She plays Sheila, a lawyer dismissed from her job because she claims to hear the voice of God, which, ironically, is the premise of one of CBS's new shows, Joan of Arcadia. Adam Arkin plays the boss at the law firm who let her go and defends his actions in court. But when it's Sheila's time to give opening remarks, she addresses the jury directly, very directly.
Imagine being considered insane for endeavoring to communicate with God. I've been so ostracized by my firm these days. God was the only one who talked to me. You talk to her, Margaret, every night. And though you think she's a he, that's okay. And Ward, I know you don't believe in her, but when your wife survived cancer, you were heard to mutter, "Thank God."
What is going on here?
I'm giving my opening remarks, and I'd appreciate being allowed to finish. And this is fraud.
Objection?
Agnostic, Mitchell. Shame.
Ms. Carlyle.
Chambers. Now.
Just as well. Shirley has to pee.
The Practice very quickly becomes the Spader and Stone show and makes the series worth watching again for the first time in years. When you're a TV fan, patience is a virtue. That's why, less than 1 week into this new season, I'm already telling myself, wait till next year.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurak directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of Last Citadel, a novel of the Battle of Kursk by David L. Robbins, author of War of the Rats. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Pat Conroy. His memoir, My Losing Season, is now out in paperback. It's about playing basketball for the military college, the Citadel, under the second toughest man he's ever met, his coach. Conroy is also the author of The Great Santini, a fictionalized portrayal of his authoritarian and abusive father. Join us for the next Fresh Air.